Good evening and welcome to the 49th District Live Telephone Town Hall. My name is Lilia and I'll be moderating tonight's call. Thank you for taking the time to join us. We hope you'll find this call informative. In a moment, I'll turn the phone over to State Representatives Jim Moeller and Sharon Wiley and Senator Annette Cleveland for some opening remarks. But first, I want to explain how this call is going to work. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 3 on your phone right now. You'll be connected with a staff person who'll take your question and get you into the queue to speak with the lawmakers. This is a live question and answer session, so we want to get through as many of your questions as possible during this call. We have to limit participants to only one question each. Again, please press star 3 right now. That's all you need to do to ask your question. Here's some information on your lawmakers. Representative Jim Moeller currently serves as Speaker pro tempore in the House of Representatives. He's a former chair of the Southwest Washington Health District Board. He's a charter member of the Southwest Washington Visitors and Convention Bureau, a former board member of the Association of Washington Cities, and an honorary board member for Big Brothers Big Sisters. Jim has been a healthcare professional for more than 25 years. Remember, please press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question. Representative Sharon Wiley serves as Vice Chair of the Government Accountability and Oversight Committee. She has worked in business and government as a management consultant and in government relations. She also organized the Farmers Market, staffed the Rape Crisis Center, and served two terms in the Oregon Legislature. She is a board member of Clark County's Council for the Homeless and of Affordable Community Environments. Sharon is an avid backpacker and an oil painter, and she has a BA in political science. So once more, press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question. And finally, Senator Annette Cleveland brings 30 years of public and private sector knowledge to Olympia, including working as staff for two U.S. senators, 5 years at the Vancouver Columbian, and her current position in administration at a nonprofit healthcare organization. She also serves on the Association of Washington Business Board of Directors, the Washington State Hospital Association's Public Policy Advisory Group, and the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce's Public Policy Advisory Committee. Okay, and now here they are. Remember, press star 3 on your phone right now. Representatives Jim Moeller and Sharon Wiley and Senator Annette Cleveland with opening remarks.
Good evening. My name is Jim Moeller, and I would like to welcome you all to our telephone town hall. My opening remarks would be simply that I'm anxious to hear your questions. I sit on the healthcare committee. I have since I got here at in Olympia. I'm also on transportation and labor and workforce development.
Hi, folks. This is Sharon Wiley. I'm like Jim. I'm more willing to listen and answer questions than talk. We're here to hear from you. It's been a really, really intense week, and we are at one of our cutoff points, so this is a great time to take a deep breath and hear from the folks at home. Thanks for calling.
And hello, everyone. This is State Senator Annette Cleveland, and I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It is truly a privilege to serve you as State Senator for the 49th Legislative District. And as you probably recall, I was elected in 2012. I currently sit on the Healthcare, K-12 Education and Early Learning, and Transportation Committees. And I am looking forward to our discussion this evening. And again, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much. Folks, remember, please press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question. And we have a lot of callers on this call, so we're going to thank you if you're patient with us. We're going with Rick from Vancouver, who has a has a question about the Oil Transportation Safety Bill. Hello, Rick?
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Please go ahead and ask your question.
Yeah, this is for Annette Cleveland. First of all, I was very thrilled to support you, and I'm glad you were elected. I'd like to know if we can get your support for HB 2347.
Well, Rick, thank you for your question. Thank you very much for your kind comment as well. I first want to ask, does that House bill have a companion bill? Because I did sign on to Senator Christine Rolfes's Oil Transportation Safety Bill, and I believe this House bill may well be the companion to that.
I'm sorry, Annette. It's just a one-question thing, so there's no back and forth.
Oh, all right. Well, Rick, I hope that I'm referring to the correct bill then, but I do absolutely believe that we must protect our communities and our residents, ensure that they're as safe as possible. Obviously, there have been many fatal oil train accidents of late, and we need to make sure that our state, and particularly our community, is certainly as prepared as possible if the worst should happen. So unfortunately, Senator Rolfes's bill did not advance in the Senate, but I intend to continue working with my colleagues here and Senator Rolfes to continue to pursue transportation safety in our state.
Although the bill did actually advance in the House.
Yes, it did. So it's coming over to the Senate, and I was one of the sponsors of that bill, and it's a pretty good, strong bill, and I'm hoping it gets through the Senate.
All right. Thank you very much. Folks, remember, press star 3 on your keypad right now to get on the question and answer queue. And now we're going with Mary from Vancouver, who has a question about the Columbia River crossing.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering, I'm very confused about what's going on with the bridge, the CRC, and I read so much in the paper and there's conflicting reports. Can you just kind of clear things up where we are today? Thank you.
Well, Mary, thank you for your question. As far as I'm aware, it's all in Oregon's hands at the moment. They have had a hearing, I believe last week, and we had representation there from the city and from the state legislature. I believe Senator Cleveland went down, and we were able to join, both myself and Sharon were able to join via telephone. But at this moment, that's my understanding, is it's all in Oregon's hands.
I agree. Oregon is going to be making a decision very, very soon in their short session, and that will kind of determine what happens going forward.
And Mary, this is Senator Cleveland. Thank you for your question. And yes, I continue to feel that replacing that antiquated drawbridge between Vancouver and Portland over the Columbia River continues to be a necessity. And I did travel to Salem last week to share with Oregon lawmakers our Washington perspective, and I was able to carry with me to share with them a letter signed by a majority of legislators in the Washington State Legislature indicating their support for replacing the interstate bridge. So it will be an issue that you can be assured we will continue to do all we can to help advance.
All right. Thank you very much. Folks, if you're just joining us, you are participating in a telephone town hall where you're 49th District lawmakers. And now we're going to go with Angela, who has a question about Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Angela?
Yeah, I was curious as to why at Southwest Washington in Vancouver, Washington, why there was a three-year waiting list to get any assistance with Big Brother, Big Sisters. And if there was anything that you guys could do to make that more available for youth.
Yeah, Angela, I'm not aware that there was such a list, although I can certainly, as you well know, I can make a phone call and find out why there is such a list. It's probably an issue of funding.
All right,
this is Sharon. It may also be an issue of community volunteers as well.
Yes, either one.
All right, thank you very much. Please press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question. And we have a poll, so let's get that one started. Let's see. The question is going to be whether or not you support the minimum wage to raise people out of to lift people out of poverty. And this is a hot issue right now, as you all know, so we're going to try to get as many of your opinions as possible. If you do agree with raising the minimum wage, please press 1 on your keypad. And if you do not agree with raising the minimum wage to lift people out of poverty, then please press 2. All right. So thank you very much. And now we're going to go with Joanne, who has a question about oil trains. Yeah, another hot topic. Joanne?
Yes. I've been doing a lot of research on the oil trains and the Tesoro Savage thing, and there's been so much more publicity on the coal trains to the north of us that I feel like the state needs to be a lot more proactive on the amount of rail traffic that's going to happen in our state and along the Columbia River, as well as right through the heart of Vancouver. And it's really scary knowing the record of Tesoro's non-compliance with the safety things. So I'm just going to ask you if you can do something to get it more widely discussed in the state.
Actually, the issue of coal and oil has been fairly heavily discussed in the House. I'm not so sure about the Senate. But we have a very active committee. I believe that you're even on it, or were close to it.
The Economic Development, Technology, and Energy Committee had a number of presentations from the UTC, and right now the permitting process is and the siting process is in FSEC, which is the siting committee, and they make a recommendation to the governor, who has the final say so. But they have about 40,000 inputs and questions and concerns from both individuals and different jurisdictions. And that process is probably going to take a year to a year and a half. If you have particular concerns that you think may not have been considered, I can still bring some of those forward and just contact my office on that. There is a town meeting that's been organized by folks that are concerned about it that is this Saturday morning at
March 1st
at the Kiggins Theater, and there is that town hall, and so I will be at that town hall, as well as a lot of other community leaders and citizens that are concerned. The House just passed a bill to require to do what we can. The issue is more complex and confusing because there are federal railroad, state, and local issues at hand, and the state has invested very heavily in making sure that there is adequate rail system, and we've also invested with the city into the waterfront. And so I, for one, feel that the state has a strong interest, and I've been paying a lot of attention to this issue and will continue to do so.
All right. Thank you. We have a poll going, folks. If you agree with raising the minimum wage to lift people out of poverty, please press 1 on your keypad. If you don't agree with raising the minimum wage to lift people out of poverty, please press 2. And we're going to continue with John, who has a question about the fact that the country is polarized. John?
Yes?
Please ask your question.
My question was, it seems to me that our country is more polarized now, I'm 65 years old, than any time in the history of my life that I can remember. It seems like that we're both sides are getting entrenched regardless of issues. And do these politicians that are talking right now have any thoughts or ideas on how we can close that gap and become a little bit more respectful of one another and treat each other in a better way where we can solve problems together?
Well, John, this is Annette. Thank you for your question, and I think that there are a number of things that all of us can do, and then a number of things that we as legislators can do. I think, first of all, one of the things that all of us can do as citizens is when we're making those hard decisions as to who it is we're going to elect to represent us, at any level of government, I believe we need to consider what values they're going to bring to that work, rather than perhaps making our decision to who we're going to vote for based solely on a position they might have on a specific issue. And when I speak of values, I mean things like teamwork and honesty and just considering how it is they're going to go about the business. I think that as legislators, there are a number of things that we can do. Obviously, I think that we have to always begin the conversation looking for those things that we share in common and start from that point. I think also we have to work to try to address whether we hold dear what's I think at the core sometimes of the pioneers who settled the Northwest. Are we rugged individuals, or are we in fact a community that supports one another? And I think sometimes we tend to divide based upon which we value. So,
well, John, this is Jim Mueller. I thanks for your question. One thing that was left off of my bio is that I spent 2 years on the city council, two terms on the city council, not 2 years. Seems like 2 years. But it was a very learning process because we didn't have R's or D's after our names. We were a council that was focused on solving problems. And I think there's a great deal of difference between a campaign and when you get up in a position either here or on the city council or on a school board, that you have to work with people, all kinds of different people. People become less R's or D's, but more just people trying to solve problems. As Speaker Pro Tem, I found that to be true of everybody on the House floor, that regardless of their motivations for introducing a bill, we are all Americans at the very core, and we all want to solve the problems. The question has become, how do we get there, and how do we solve this problem? My politics is the politics of compromise. I think that is the idea that we all strive to achieve.
And this is Sharon. I think we all need to, whether we're an elected official or not, we need to spend more time listening and trying to understand the people that disagree with us the most. I've recently learned that our computers and our internet searches get tailored to what we want to hear in some respects, and we all hang out with people that we have that we basically agree with. And the wonderful thing about serving in public office is that you have to solve really big problems with people that you don't agree or share a similar or identical worldview. And it's hard work. And the other thing that you have to remember is that negativity and conflict is what's exciting and interesting to our newspapers and to our discussion. But a lot of the things we work on together we're in agreement and we work to solve those things together. And so there's probably polarization is worse than it's ever been, but there is more agreement than what it looks like. And we need to remember that and inform ourselves. And I think all of us need to spend time really trying to understand the other side. And that's kind of hard work sometimes, but I think it's necessary.
Yeah, I think you're right, Sharon. I think that what we end up with is really a lot of people who want to solve problems.
Well, I always try to remember that my most opposite political non-friend doesn't get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say, I'm going to go out and do the wrong thing. Everybody here is trying to do the right thing, and it doesn't work very well unless you remember that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. We're about to close the poll, folks, so please press number one on your keypad if you support raising the minimum wage to lift people out of poverty, and number two if you do not support raising the minimum wage. And please press star 3 on your keypad if you have a question. And we're going with Jim, who has a question about education and special needs.
Yes, Southwest Washington legislative delegation has had a history of strong support for special needs kids with both the what was formerly the School for the Deaf, and most people still call it that despite the name change, and the School for the Blind here located, co-located here in Vancouver, and the rise of, meteoric rise of kids with diagnosed with autism and other special needs children. So our legislative delegation still continue to give strong support and look for ways to provide money in the budget to support special needs children, even as the economy takes its inevitable cyclical ups and downs?
Jim, this is Sharon. Absolutely. We've got a long history of supporting those schools and advocating for them on a statewide basis. And there's two places where that comes into play. One is in the capital budget to make sure that the facilities are adequate. And the other is in the programming. And the third piece that goes to K through 12 across the board, as well as the School for the Deaf and the School for the Blind and for the special needs such as autism, is early intervention. And we're making a very bipartisan and strong commitment to early childhood education, which includes doing what needs to be done at the earliest possible point, because that's what allows kids to thrive over the long term, even if they have individually extra challenges. I think that's probably the most bipartisan issue that we have to work on, and the challenge is a tax system that really is unsustainable and problematic, and the differences of opinion on how to fix it are where we are polarized sometimes.
Most times.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. So we have closed the poll, and let me tell you the results. 65% of you do support raising the minimum wage to lift people out of poverty, and, well, 35 of you don't. So that's what it looks like. And please remember to press star 3 on your phone if you have a question. We have about half an hour left of this call, and we're trying to get to as many of you as possible, so please be patient. We're going with Rich, who has a question about bringing jobs to Washington. Rich?
Yes, I am here.
Hi, please go ahead and ask your question.
I would like to understand why, how you're going to bring jobs to the state, considering that there's so much, the representation is that they want to lower minimum wage or just not increase it. How are you going to get more jobs for people if you're trying to drop wages at the same time, but you want to increase the number of jobs?
Well, Rick, I think there's a couple of different issues we can address. One is through the different kinds of budgets that we have. We have a transportation budget, which we put nearly 80% of that transportation budget to the private sector to create exactly what your question is regarding, is about jobs in our community. You know, food on the table, clothes on people's backs. So those are important to everybody. There are other budgets, particularly with the general fund budget or the capital budget, that also bring specific jobs to the private sector. A lot of what we do is encourage other businesses to thrive. And I think that's a unique thing amongst everybody who comes to the legislature, is that we all want to see our local communities thrive and prosper.
That's right, Rich, and this is Annette. One of the reasons that I chose to step up and run for office was because I feel so strongly that we need to do all that we can to ensure that our community remains one of opportunity for everyone, just as it's been one of opportunity for you and me and our those who have come before us. But I believe that the single most important thing that we can do to help spur jobs and economic development in our community and in our state is to invest in infrastructure. We need to invest in transportation, and we need to invest in other types of infrastructure so that others will invest in us. You know, I co-sponsored a bill this session, Senate Bill 6120, to help to restore the Public Works Trust Fund. And that fund was unfortunately swept last year in order to help pay for some of the essential services that our state provides. But I feel strongly that it's important for us to, as I say, put money toward infrastructure so that others will hopefully step up and invest in us as well.
And this is Sharon. I sit on both higher education and the Economic Development, Energy and Technology Committee. And one of the things that we're doing is concentrating on the things that enhance and build the industries that are targeted and known to be able to produce jobs of the future. And for us, that means our agricultural sector, our aerospace, biotech, high-tech, and export businesses and industries. And those apply throughout the state. And for and we need to make sure that the energy needed to run those businesses is available, that the people are educated in the right way, and that they have access to that education, and that we have the infrastructure. And Jim talked about infrastructure. That means that we have to have roads and bridges that work. We have to have the ability for adults to go back and get additional education. And we need to market the fact that we have cheap energy, and it comes from a lot of different sources. And we are the fact that we have green energy and hydro is a big asset, and that's how come we can get high-tech businesses to come here, even though on a worldwide basis we are a little bit out of the way. But the fact that we have secure energy and water, and that we care about keeping those things available, gives us an edge internationally.
Yeah, I think there are two questions here, really. One, what do we do in the short term to create jobs in our community? And the second is long term. You know, what do we do on the long basis to bring in more jobs? I think, Sharon, you were right on when you talked about education being a key aspect of that in the long term. But I think also in the short term, we can look to the state to create those investments, just as you were saying, Annette, with in transportation, you know, fixing our infrastructure, fixing our interchanges, developing new highways and safety for all those people.
Absolutely. And our capital budget, for instance, helps communities provide infrastructure like a new sewer plant and roads and electrical right-of-way and all of that.
Okay, thank you very much. Please press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question for your lawmakers. And we're going with Judy, who has a question about the transportation budget.
Good evening. This is Judy Tiffany, and I want to know why Clark County gets such a small part of the transportation budget compared to how much money we pay into it.
I'm going to give that to our good senator, Annette Cleveland.
Well, thank you, sir. Hi, Judy. Good to hear from you. Thank you for your question. And unfortunately, yes, Clark County is a donor county. We tend to pay in to the state's transportation fund and pay more than we oftentimes get back. But know that in this latest budget proposal that was put forward by the Majority Coalition Caucus in the Senate,
which is basically the Republicans.
The Republicans in the Senate. There was almost nothing designated for funding in the 49th Legislative District. So I have put together a list of transportation funding priorities for our community, and I have made it clear to my colleagues in the Senate, and specifically the two co-chairs of the Senate Transportation Committee, that I will be unable to support any package that does not include those priorities for funding.
Okay,
Judy,
thank you.
You're so right, and it's not okay, and we will do everything we can in our power to correct that.
Yeah, the House has already passed its package, Judy, so, and it included millions, hundreds of millions of dollars for Southwest Washington, because I think we're basically all in this together. All of Southwest Washington, I mean, the 19th district in Cowlitz County, the 20th district, the 17th, the 18th, the 49th legislative districts, all are concerned about the level of funding. And amazingly enough, one of the co-chairs of the Senate Transportation Committee actually represents part of Clark County, which is, to me, is always surprising.
Okay, thank you. We have about 25 minutes left of this call, so if you have a question, please press star 3 and we will get to you. We're going with Joseph, who has a question about legalization of marijuana.
Hi, I'm Joseph, and I'm from Vancouver. My question is, what is taking so long to get the marijuana to stores and to create jobs and stuff like that so we could help pay for the bridge to Oregon?
Well, Joseph, this is Sharon, and I'm on the committee that's taking care of one part of that. Part of the reason that it's taking so long is that the initiative was very, very specific in how we had to do it and what the results had to be, and the federal government also has something to say about it. And we, to our mistake or to our dismay, we did not do what we should have done to have a real system for our medical marijuana. Colorado had a very organized system for medical marijuana, and so they were able to move a lot quicker. But we are trying to walk the fine line of bringing the medical marijuana system into a new system that doesn't exist. Because of the liquor initiative, the system that the marijuana initiative was counting on doesn't exist anymore. So we're trying to do multiple things at the same time, and the Liquor Control Board had had some rulemaking things that they had to do. The health department and we've divided it among several committees. We are relying on the Liquor Control Board to do what they do with cigarettes and with alcohol. And we're moving as fast as we can, and we're getting closer. The most problematic issue right now is the question of whether or not individual cities and counties can or should opt out. And some of us feel that everybody needs to be in order for this to be a safe, legal system. But the initiative itself was not specific, and it takes a two-thirds vote to change anything in that initiative. So it is complex. I'm very committed to creating a system that is fair to everybody, where people that need medical marijuana can get it at a fair price and know exactly what they're getting, and that we can make sure that we're not hammered on by the federal government as well, and that we are able to tax it and in a way that's low enough that we do not have a criminal market anymore. The problem of cities opting out is a threat to having such a system.
Yeah, Joseph. All right. Actually, the economic forecast that came out today or yesterday, I think it was, depends upon $51 million of that depends upon us taxing marijuana. So without those monies, we end up with a lot lower economic forecast, totally.
And one more thing, Joseph. Your city of Vancouver is moving ahead because the city folks that represent the city of Vancouver believe that it's their duty to cite the things and the outlets and make sure they're available and to be part of the overall system. They are not opting out, and they are one of the cities that's moving ahead as good partners with the state.
Good.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, if you have a question, please press star 3 on your keypad. Right now we're going with Daniel, who is wondering about the bridge and worrying about light rail later. Daniel?
Yes, I was wondering why we do not fund the bridge now, because a lot of people have been against the light rail and have the bridge built so that in the future after it is built, then maybe people will change their minds about light rail, and it might be a lot easier situation. As it is now, it's a continual conflict.
Well, thank you. Well, first of all, thanks a bunch for the question. In many ways, your question is kind of moot, in because the entire issue is in Oregon's hands. Portland and Oregon have decided that light rail is going to be part of the bridge, and that's the question before them now. The Washington State Senate Transportation Committee has walked away from funding any transportation package, and maybe Senator Cleveland can add to that with her experience last week.
Well, Daniel, thank you for the question, and I certainly see your point, but as Representative Moeller just shared, the decision as to what the project would look like was made very laboriously by 39 stakeholders who came together, studied the data, and agreed unanimously to what's called the locally preferred alternative, which is the project as it's proposed today. That project includes, as you know, light rail as the mode of transit. The federal dollars that have been identified for the bridge, the $850 million, are designated solely for building light rail. And so if light rail is not a part of this bridge and isn't operated immediately, then we wouldn't be eligible for that money. And frankly, I don't believe it is a good use of our tax dollars to try to build a bridge that we perhaps call light rail ready, if you will, and we've spent money investing in light rail readiness, but we don't then operate light rail because there's no guarantee we would ever operate light rail on that project. So it would be a shame to spend the dollars building the infrastructure for light rail if we could. So.
Okay, thank you. This call is going great. We have a lot of you on the line, so we really appreciate that. If you have a question, please press star 3 on your keypad, and you will be transferred to a staff person who will take it. We're going with Rick, who has a question or a comment about House Bill 2108.
Yes. First of all, it's basically four quick comments. I want to compliment you on the phone town hall format. It's the first time we've joined, and look forward to doing that in the future. Secondly, I feel very privileged to live in an area that has such fine representation as Jim and Annette and Sharon. Yes. And Jim, I want to thank you for helping pass engross House Bill 2108 in the House. And Annette, I look forward to your support when it comes through the Healthcare Committee next Tuesday morning. Thank
Absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, Rick. Thank you for your comment and
kind
words.
What 2108 is?
Yes, House Bill 2108 has to do with the dispensing of hearing aids, and I am looking forward to working on that bill, having it come across the rotunda to the Senate, and you can absolutely count on my support.
And those of us who are in our 60s and can't hear anything in a restaurant are very, very glad that we are paying attention to this issue.
Yeah, more than you think.
What did you say?
What?
That was nice.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys are very funny. So let's see. We are going to go now with Jennifer, who has a question about teacher colas.
Hi, this is Jennifer from Vancouver, and I'm just, you know, there's an incredible amount of pressure on teachers with the new Common Core state standards and new teacher evaluation. Principal teachers are working harder than ever, and I'm wondering, is there any support or intention to replace the COLA?
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer. Appreciate the question. Yes, that is an issue that we've been working diligently on here. I know that I signed on to the support for a cost of living adjustment and you know, feel strongly that we've been directed by the voters to provide those cost of living adjustments. And so I'll continue to support that, do all I can to advance that.
Our teachers have waited a long time for a little bit of a raise, and we're doing everything we can. The as I said earlier, the economy and the revenues have not quite recovered, and we have a very limited tax system, but for me, this is a priority. I signed on to this issue to support it, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do something that we need to do before the end of this session.
Well, Jennifer, this is Jim, and I agree. In fact, I signed on to also the teacher's COLA here in the House, but at the same time, none of the state workers have received COLAs. And which is appropriate because we're facing a very difficult financial situation over the last several years with the recession. But at the same time, and my sister is a teacher, has been for almost 40 years, is that everybody both needs to raise when we talk about COLAs and cost of living adjustments. Because everybody's cost of living has gone up, but our salaries, everyone's salaries, has not. So I think America actually needs a raise.
Okay, thank you. We have about 16, 17 minutes left, so let's try to get to as many of you as possible. Again, if you have a question, please press star 3 on your phone. And we're going with Catherine, who is wondering about the rationale behind the support for the DREAM Act.
Hi, Catherine. This is Sharon.
Catherine?
Hi,
Catherine. Please ask your question.
Okay, this is Catherine from Vancouver, and I'm wondering if you would each please share your rationale behind your recent votes on the, what she's calling the Dream Bill, and do you worry that this will actually draw more illegals into our state to take advantage of this benefit?
Catherine, this is Sharon. I serve on the Higher Education Committee. And the DREAM Act is actually very specific. The kids that this applies to came here. The act requires that they be brought here not of their own volition. The young people that this applies to are kids that have grown up here. Some of them don't even know that they are undocumented until they've been admitted to college. This DREAM Act gives kids that have lived their whole life here, who have worked really hard, whose parents have paid taxes, access to compete for some financial aid. Our business community tells us that we need all of the educated people we can get, and this is something that you might be surprised at who is undocumented. After listening to all of the testimony and looking at the statistics, this DREAM Act only applies to about 600 kids. And like I said, their parents have paid taxes. They've paid taxes. They've worked really hard, and it makes sense. We are a nation of immigrants, and we need to educate the people that are part of our communities.
Yeah, Catherine, I supported the DREAM Act or the HOPE Act or whatever they call it. And quite honestly, these are the kids that you want to have in your college system. I mean, these are the kids who have worked hard, who want to apply to for the state need grant. And it doesn't guarantee anything. It doesn't guarantee that they're funded. It doesn't guarantee that they even be accepted. But it does guarantee that they can apply. And I think that is a basic issue of fairness. So.
And Catherine, I would add, this is Annette, that appreciate your question, and these students have to meet the criteria like any other student would in order to be eligible. So, I think that any time that we can support anyone's dream to attend college and obtain education, we should. And I did support the DREAM Act or the Real HOPE Act,
whatever it is, we called it
in the Senate.
All right. Thank you very much. And we're going now with Benjamin, who has a question about tax breaks for corporations. Benjamin.
Hi.
Hi. Please
Hello.
Ask your question.
My question is basically, we've been hearing a lot of stories in the news about major corporations, some of which will remain nameless, that have basically threatened the government that if they don't receive often tax breaks, but sometimes also environmental breaks on the local laws or zoning laws or whatever, that they'll move out of state. I'm kind of wondering, how do we, obviously these are major job providers, how do we keep these kind of businesses in state without engaging in a kind of a race to the bottom where these companies end up not contributing as much to the infrastructure that we need?
Well, Benjamin, I think one of the things that we did last night on the House floor was that we passed a bill that actually increases the transparency of these tax breaks. There's over 650 different tax incentives, as they're called, that are practically hidden from knowing, one, how much say, for example, Microsoft has given to us in taxes, but we don't know what their total income has been nationwide or worldwide. So how do we compare that? This bill that we passed last night actually opens up only 19 different tax breaks for these corporations that expands the transparency, so we can make some really hard decisions about whether these are appropriate for the state anymore, whether we get an investment back, a return back on our investment. And I think that's honest and on the very core level, that we have to have some basic data to make honest decisions about whether these continued tax breaks continue.
And Jim, Benjamin, I think that one of the things that's hardest for people not involved in this process to understand is, why haven't we done it sooner, and why is it such a big battle to find out what we should be able to find out? A lot of corporations over the last 100 years that have gotten these breaks have fought hard to keep them private because they don't want their competitors to know anything. And I think that we're in a new age. We can't afford to give things away that don't provide value to taxpayers. And we have, as modest as it sounds, we have just recently passed some incredible legislation that provides better public policy for analyzing and evaluating in a true form. Some of the things that we do make sense. And we would continue to do them if we knew enough. But one of the things that I recently found out through interacting with other elected officials in other states is that legislators like ourselves are starting to talk amongst each other and say, how do we avoid being whipsawed by corporations and played off against each other? And what kind of policies can we develop about how we grow our own businesses without setting ourselves up for our companies to play us off against each other? And I'm very heartened by those kinds of conversations because nobody likes to feel bullied or feel like their corporate family is extorting from them. And I think that, you know, I'm all for transparency. I'm all for questioning, and I'm all for doing the right thing. Part of the reason that we are so buried in corporate tax breaks is that we have a tax system that doesn't make sense, and so we keep tweaking it to try to make it work and try to get what we need from our businesses. And I think that we need a grassroots movement to question what kind of tax system makes sense in this day and age.
I agree.
Well said.
Okay, we have about, 9 minutes left of this call, so let's try and get this done quickly. We're going with Kimberly, who has a question about funding for school transportation. Kimberly, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Please go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. While I was attending the Washington State PTA Focus Day on February 4th, I got to meet with one of my representatives who very briefly mentioned funding for school transportation. Can you clarify or elaborate on this, and is there a timeline in place?
Is there a what in place?
A timeline?
Kimberly, this is Sharon. I don't sit on the K through 12 committee, and so I am not sure. This funding for school transportation becomes part of the money we give to schools in the final budget, and all of that is kind of negotiated towards the end as part of a package. What problem are you seeing in terms of how we're doing that right now? And I can get back to you, or you can call one of our offices individually and we can do a little digging and find out exactly. What's going on right now. But could you, I just realized that you can't respond to this. So if you could call our offices, any one of us would be happy to dig a little deeper. And that goes for other people that are listening here too. If there's something you want to know more about, that's what we're here for, is to make sure we share the information we're privy to, and that it's that our the people we represent can know.
Exactly.
And Kimberly, I would add to that, you know, Representative Wiley is absolutely correct in that funding for school transportation is very much a part of the broader discussion that's going on regarding our ability as a state to meet our constitutional obligation to fully fund education. And that is an ongoing conversation, and obviously school transportation is necessary and needed.
Exactly. The whole idea about what is included in a basic education, K through 12, has been in front of the courts a couple of different times. In fact, the last time we knew it as the McCleary decision, and in the House we're still trying to fund we're still trying to figure out what is amply provide for our which is our paramount duty in our Constitution.
All right, thank you. So we have about 4.5 minutes left. So we're going to take one last question, and then we're going to go to closing remarks. So let's go with Rich, who has a question about economics and the budget. Rich?
Hello.
Hi. Please ask a question about cuts.
Okay, basically, you cannot cut your way into a better economy. I mean, like, if you have a job, you don't cut your own pay and your own hours so you can pay off your debt faster. So obviously you can't cut your way to a better economy. So explain why some people think they can cut their way into a better economy.
Well, Rich, I think that what we're stuck in is a kind of a classic example of how do we get there. For some of us, It's closing those loopholes and raising taxes, and for other people, it's not closing those loopholes and lowering wages. So, and what we end up with is a compromise between those two of either closing those loopholes, part of what we did, and raising some more money, some more taxes, part of what we did, and we fund the best we can with many different kinds of pressures on us.
Jim, you're talking about dueling economic theories, and you know, most people do believe, they try to support what they already believe. I have to tell you, Rich and other folks that are listening, when I was appointed in 2011, I became part of a very aggressive and lively freshman class who had already were well on their way to demanding that we pull back on this out-of-state bank loophole that was enough to fund kindergarten through third grade class size reductions. And it was unthinkable to people on the other side of the aisle that we should even talk about doing that. The very next year, that idea came forward from both sides of the aisle, and we made progress on that. The bill we passed last night forces us to look at things that we haven't ever looked at before. And so change comes slowly, but it does come. And our economy, we balanced the budget last year without additional cuts, and we probably will this year by delaying capital budget expenditures that that we normally would use. And you know, we're juggling, but we're going to do the best we can.
All right, so we are really almost done here. We want to thank you for joining us tonight. And if you did not get to ask your question, please stay on the line after the call ends. You will have an opportunity to leave messages for your lawmakers, or you can always contact them in their offices. And for that, you can just go to the website for House Democrats, Washington State House Democrats. Just Google it right now. I just don't have time to tell you right now. But anyway, so just stay on the line, leave a message, and closing remarks right now.
All right. Well, this is Senator Cleveland. I, as I said, it's a privilege to serve you, and I appreciate your listening in tonight. I know that I'm going to continue to work hard to fight for you and focus on those things that are important to us in our community, specifically access to quality education, access to quality jobs, access to quality health care. Thank you.
And this is Sharon. Thank you so much for tuning in and asking the right questions and having such a good discussion with us. Look forward to hearing from folks more.
And this is Jim, and I'd echo the comments of my colleagues, and just to say thank you for sharing your evening with us tonight.